are listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Meg Riley here in Minneapolis, Minnesota, welcoming you to another fun-packed episode of The View. I'm sorry to say we didn't go live last week. We had tech issues, and hopefully we're good today. Aisha.
Hi, I'm Aisha Hauser in Seattle, Washington. It's been rainy and stormy during the week, so hopefully it's calming down a little bit.
And behind the chalice, we have Jessica Starrockers, who's also in the Seattle area. And Aisha and Jessica have both been dealing with storm issues. So that is why Jessica's hiding behind that chalice. She's trying to save the bits for us. So hopefully we'll have no problems today. Right. I'm really excited that we're joined by two guests today
from
the Standing on the Side of Love campaign. We have Nora Rassman, the campaign manager, and Elizabeth Wynn, newly and permanently appointed, I don't mean forever, but as opposed to temporarily, the senior strategist. So we're really excited to catch up with them. And I'd love everybody to talk a little bit, since we didn't go live last week, about the elections, because there were some exciting things that happened. Went to a big celebration for Andrea Jenkins, who's one of the two new transgender Black people on the Minneapolis City Council. And, you know, we all pretty much thought that she would win because she was pretty much uncontested and super, she's been in city politics forever, you know, and really anointed by the powers that be. But, you know, what was really amazing to me was Philippe Cunningham defeated, who has been in city council for 20 years, taking her husband's seat, who had been in for decades before that, taking his father's seat, who had been in for decades before that. And she was really, like, she was the only one who voted against repealing the spitting and lurking law. She was just horrible on issues related to racism. And she was serving the North Side, which has a big Black population, but she would continually only represent the business people over there. So I was really excited about Philippe. I mean, I'm delighted about Andrea. She's an old hand. She will be, one of the leaders, because we have a really different city council now. We have three new Black members. We have, as I said, two trans members. We have a number of the incumbents are out, and it's just going to be a much more progressive city council. Meanwhile, sadly, the mayoral election went to somebody really funded by business money and somebody who misrepresents himself, I believe, as very, very progressive, but does not bear that out in what he does. So we'll see. It's going to be an interesting time here. How about Seattle, Aisha? Are you in Seattle? I don't understand.
I live in Seattle, yes. So okay, we had the first gay mayor, Ed Murray, resign in disgrace. And then we had two women, but there were really three women who ran through the primary. And I was supporting Nikita Oliver, who is a progressive slam poet, woman of color, who's just amazing. She didn't win. She got edged out by Carrie Moon and Jenny Durkin. It wasn't even close. So Jenny Durkin is a former United States attorney, won. And just as you described, I mean, she's somebody who, she was actually an Obama appointee as United States attorney, but so she was very well connected. A lot of the wealthy people in Seattle voted for her. So she won. It wasn't even close. And we'll see. The good news about Washington State is we finally flipped Congress, the state house, because it was like by one or two vote. I think it was by one vote that the Republicans were just were in charge and were wreaking havoc on our school budget, on nothing. It was just, you know, they were stalling. So that's a huge deal. So now the entire state house is in Democratic hands, and we have a Democratic governor who's been fighting the, you know, 45, like, just, they've been filing all kinds. We have an awesome attorney general. So I'm hopeful. I don't know about the city of Seattle. Business interests reign supreme here, because it's, you know, we're the land of Amazon. And so I'm not sure. We have a really heinous homeless population, and Ed Murray just keeps clearing encampments with no plan. And so we need to have a plan. We're one of the wealthiest cities in this country, and there's no plan. It's just, it's heartbreaking. So I don't think we should, I don't think we have a right to call ourselves liberal just because we're well-meaning. And we, I just think if we don't take care of the least among us, then it's kind of BS. So.
You have one of my favorite Congress people out there too, Pramila Jayapal.
Pramila, yeah.
Who hangs out with my Congressman, Keith Ellison. They seem to do a lot together.
So Pramila, it's, here's an, she has a UU connection. Her ex-husband is married to Cecilia Kingman, who's one of our UU ministers, so, which is interesting. But yeah, Pramila, she's outspoken and she's out there. So yeah, well, let's hope for the best. I really, you know, the day after the election, there were posts going around like, well, don't get too excited because there's still people who like Trump. Okay, and people who came out and voted did this. So can we just celebrate for a flipping day? Like, stop. So anyway,
I mean, here what happened, like Andre Jenkins was supported by the Democratic powers that be because there was not an incumbent. But other progressives who were running, the Democratic Party was supporting the incumbents, not the progressive people. And I feel like, as I look at it, the lessons to be taken that the Democrats seem to be solidly ignoring are stop thinking about the Trump voters, stop thinking about the white working class, do something to bring out people of color. Because if you look at the Virginia statistics, if only white people had voted, it would have been overwhelmingly for that Republican guy. But I feel like the Democrats just keep not getting that message. So when people are like, that's great for 2018, I'm like, maybe, but it's gonna, you know, we sure can't count on the Democrats to do it. I feel like there's as much of a, the progressives and the Democratic stronghold as there is in the Republican Party, but it's just, I don't know, it's kind of weirdly ignored.
Well, money still reigns. There's a lot of rich liberals and progressives who still want to keep a certain amount of the status quo. And so the rich, they're not progressive, but the rich Democrats want just enough window dressing to make this look like it's helping people. But yet not really make fundamental change. So the Democratic Party, it, like, I agree with you. I think there's the same battle, you know, kind of fight for the soul. So I actually have no use. I don't give money to the Democratic Party. And it's not that I don't support individual races, but I think the whole committee needs to kind of go away.
I was really bummed that Keith Ellison didn't win. He had a really good plan. Well, you look like you got stuff to say here. You're nodding and... How'd it go? You live in Boston, right? Where do you live now?
Oh, I live in D.C.
Oh, you live in D.C. Also, you're in a colony out there.
I'm in a colony, but I would say there were a lot of lessons for us gearing up for our the primaries in April. And feels so resonant with the Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Seattle, and Boston, which is like deep liberalism, lots and lots of money. Mayors that run on probably like anti-gentrification and then flip as soon as they get in. I've been super energized and excited by the Movement for Black Lives kind of electoral justice project and kind of them identifying candidates from city council and school board all the way up to senator and congresspeople and like really doing base building around supporting Black progressive candidates to like get in. So yeah, I was feeling that tension also, Aisha, around, great, this is powerful. There's like so much to learn from what happened and folks turned out in mass. And a question that I feel like I don't have answers to is how do we actually support the folks who we've really poured into their campaigns once they're elected, knowing the amount of negotiation and just deep pressure politically and financially that they, you know, come under, even on a very local level. So I don't think it is like the strategy, but it did give me a little piece of hope. I was specifically watching this person, Vernetta Alston, who's a Black genderqueer person who won it for city council in Durham, who a lot of people connected to Southerners on New Ground were supporting, and just like extraordinary community organizer slash lawyer who brought in a lot of folks who had no campaign experience that then like scaled up and really just like hit the pavement. So definitely feeling like we can take some lessons, and in DC and in other like liberally facing spaces, I think there's some deep questions about who are we running and what's the like inside outside strategy.
Elizabeth, how about Boston? Do you live in Boston proper or do you live in one of those other little towns?
Yep, just regular Boston. But yeah, very much hearing everything that everyone else is saying here. We have 6 women of color on our city council, which is incredible and all really progressive. Lydia Edwards is one of the new folks, and she is like a pro co-op, pro affordable housing lawyer who just like galvanized people, won hugely in like a super historically Italian white neighborhood, as well as a neighborhood with more folks of color. But same story in terms of a super like blue state lie, blue city lie mayor incumbent, Marty Walsh, who I just saw a tweet, like he spent $70, I think, per vote. And his challenger, who's a more progressive Black city councilor, Tito Jackson, spent $9, I think. So it's just money wins. And, you know, I think Tito definitely could have run a stronger ground game for sure. But they were pretty distinct both on education and housing, which are like the core for a lot of folks here. And Tito was like, we need more affordable housing. And Marty Walsh was like, if we build more market rate, then there'll be less pressure on the housing market. And Walsh wants to lift the cap on charters, and people are losing like libraries and AP classes every budget cycle. So I'm sitting with the energy and also the question of people in power will always preserve their self-interest. And I think that that is real in our denomination in the wider political landscape. And we've been having lots of conversations about like transform and unleash, like thinking like how much are we pushing folks in power to shift versus how much are we unleashing power of folks who already know what they need and their communities need, which I feel like a lot of you all are saying as well. And I'm a little sad too, I'll say, because we have a governor up next cycle who has come out against our equivalent of like a Sanctuary State Act. It is the most popular governor in America, Republican, Charlie Baker, also super pro charters. And there's not a sensibility that we can unseat him. I mean, people are running against him, but I'm feeling really strongly the like comfort and self-satisfaction of these urban blue wealthy places. And it's rough. It's really rough. And like other folks are saying, the complexity around people who are, you know, sit on his like immigrants advisory council, and so they're not gonna come out against him. And how do we, like you were saying, Nora, the inside outside, how do we have an ecosystem where we each play our role?
Yeah, it's complicated. We're coming into a governor's race too, because Mark Dayton, Democratic governor, is fending off the worst. We have a Republican House and Senate here. So he's vetoing a lot, thank God. But so there's this tension of who can win. And we have many, many people in the race right now. But one of the interesting ones is Tim Walz, who's this white man from rural Minnesota, who's already announced that his lieutenant governor would be Peggy Flanagan, who's a Native American woman in the House right now, who used to be on the school board and who's quite a well-known, very, very progressive activist. But so I went and heard them, and Tim Walz said he's one of only 10 rural areas now in the whole Congress. So basically the entire Congress, and his area went for Trump and him in the last election. And he's, you know, he's out there, he's pro NRA, but Peggy's not. I mean, what I love about him is they're just totally there with their disagreements and their arguments. So they kind of, I mean, as they said, they look like Minnesota. They between them, they represent Minnesota. So the question will be, because what we did just now with the mayor's race, the progressive people split our vote. I mean, there were several candidates who were running, and we have ranked choice voting in Minneapolis. But even so, we split up between a couple, 3 people, really. And Jacob Frey and the money came in on top of all of it. So anyway, it's an interesting.
See, if the Democrats had their act together, that's where strategy and organizing could be useful. It's, you know, how do you organize folks so you don't split them? But we're not even, so frustrating. So I just posted an article that was in the Seattle Times that my young adult daughter, who does not live in Seattle, she's away at school, set me, she's already annoyed at the UUs for what she experiences as us being hypocrites. So I don't know if any of you have seen it. The University Unitarian Church is doing a major renovation, $17 million, to not only update the sanctuary and their building itself, but to also expand their parking lot, which will mean 10 people who were formerly homeless living in transitional housing will be displaced. So the Seattle Times wrote, it's a pretty slanted article, not very well written. And, you know, I understand that this decision was made, you know, I totally trust those in power, you know, that it was made thoughtfully, it was made pre-teaching. And now I wonder, you know, after what happened with the election, housing in Seattle is at a more than premium. It's been kind of quietly making the rounds on Facebook, not quite as big as I was expecting, but some people have shared it. So I'm wondering I know you haven't seen the article, but it's an interesting thing because now, you know, my daughter said, Unitarians are hypocrites. And why are you building more parking spots? You're killing the earth. So very interesting.
I know in DC where this was constantly going on, a couple of the churches, National City and New York Avenue Presbyterian, ended up building housing on top of multi-level parking lots. And it was a win-win, right? Though I don't know that any of it was affordable housing. I know that there were big fights about it, but I actually left in the middle of the fights and I don't know how they worked out. But there are creative things to do about parking, right?
That's what I was thinking. And especially, you know, that's what I was thinking. I'm like, well, you know, can't you build apartments and have the lot under, I don't know. And I'm not a member of University Unitarian. So to be fair, I don't know and it's not a good look.
Yeah, I have no idea about that particular church at all. And I haven't seen the article. I'll check it out. Well, so today I'm really excited to catch up with what's going on the side of love with Nora and Elizabeth. So, well, let's start with the awkwardness around saying the campaign formerly known as the Standing on the Side of Love campaign. We voted at GA to change the name because of the ableism in Standing on the Side of Love. And I'm delighted about that change. And thank God we didn't try 4,000 of us to pick a new name. I was really happy that it went to We Will Figure This Out. So what's up with that? Either one of you.
So yeah, as you said, there was just like a beautifully extraordinary group of folks who brought the responsive resolution at General Assembly to the floor, led by Teresa Soto and Suzanne Fast, other folks connected to Equal Access, and a lot of folks. It was profound to see how many people had been involved with the campaign, including you, Meg, near the mic as the like voting was happening, just to like see the breadth of people who were showing up, including creators who I think have also done some like personal transformation work and talk very publicly, like Jason, who has rewritten. So we are moving forward with it. I think there was a UU World article kind of covering what we understood to be our mandate moving forward. We've definitely been in conversation with the authors of the resolution and wanting to continue to consult with them before any public launch. And the two things we've kind of been holding is maintaining some of the brand integrity that we know will move folks forward. So the aesthetic, we know the color is not a popular one for folks, but also not planning to like change that. And also give us the ability to just move it forward while responding to the request. So we're planning to roll out by sometime in the early new year, once some additional conversations happening, and don't mean to be intentionally opaque, but like really would like to be in conversation with folks. But you'll definitely be some of the first to hear. And the hope is that we can also facilitate some important conversations that I think folks are having about what it means for this change to have happened and this to be an identity many folks have taken on and it to be shifting. And so that really spiritually preparing people to live in this gray area around things are changing. We are not saying burn and, you know, tear down all of your things and now say standing on the side of love, but like, how have we been contributors to ableism in our own work? Where have we not been reflective or centering the experiences of folks within our faith tradition? around this kind of feedback and critique, and kind of like, what are the spiritual like requirements and practices that we need to be able to move forward in this time? I don't know if you have more.
No, that was a great summary of lots of different pieces. Yeah, echoing the gratitude for folks who drafted the resolution and who've been sharing feedback all along, and really wanting to see it as part of the spiritual journey of like, to live in this world is to be complicit in harm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, on the piece about the congregation, like thinking a similar thing, like the blessing of interconnectedness is also means that we cause each other pain, and we cannot live without doing that. And so how do we, when we know that we've harmed, move from there and do it in a way that is responsive and also isn't making undue requests for labor for folks who've been harmed, but owning, you know, that we're salaried employees who have been given a mandate to be part of this transformation. So, you know, just living with all of that and also feeling for everyone who's both like poured time and energy into the work of Side of Love over time and who's continuing to do so.
So it's not a new conversation. I mean, I'll say even right in the beginning, it was certainly an open conversation and a number of people were consulted, but I think it's exciting that things shift and change. I will say, answering the call of love, I'll just voice my opinion here. Part of on the side of love, I really hope the side of love stays in, even though there have always been people saying that there is no side of love. Love is, you know, doesn't choose sides. But I think as a campaign in part to get media, answering the call of love is like, well, yeah, sure, church people do that. But when you say side of love, you are saying with that that there are people who are not on the side of love. And so I think it's important. I think whatever work out are good, but I will put in my vote, though the song Answering the Call of Love is gorgeous. But I think for a campaign, for a public campaign, it's there's no edge to it. And so anyway, I've said my piece about it.
Well, I totally agree. And we need to stop being so ambivalent as to not have any declarative statements about who and what we are. And so I absolutely, we are on the side of love, because there are those who are not on the side of love, of interconnectedness. And you, Nora Elizabeth, you spoke so beautifully to that. And so I think, hopefully, yeah, I agree. So how is that decision going to be made? I mean, who makes the final, will it be called Answering the Call of Love or Side of Love? Who makes that decision? How is that going to happen?
I would say it's a collaboration between us and some other folks, you know, who are sort of core to justice work at the UA in consultation. But just resonating strongly on like, which side are you on, my people? Which side are you on? We're on the freedom side. And this moment slash the past, you know, 4 years and the call that in that song started in Harlan County, Kentucky, you know, with a miner's wife in a violent union struggle and has continued into the streets as part of the movement for Black Lives, and just feeling a lot of clarity with that, and also theological clarity in terms of who are we and who are the people whose backs we're having.
Well, good luck with that. So that's the name. What are you going to do? What's new and exciting? And I just need to say this, Nora, because you mentioned color. So while you're there, originally Standing on the Side of Love was supposed to have that color behind you also as one of its core colors, but we couldn't get t-shirts or anything in that color. And the yellow was more like your sweater and less like the that it is. So t-shirts ended up dictating a lot. But I always love to talk about the colors, because Adam Gerhardstein, who was the founding campaign manager, and for those who don't know, I was the founding campaign director, he was colorblind, it turned out, but he didn't tell me that when we were picking the colors. So anyway, after the fact, I learned that. But I always wished that we could have color. There just was no tchotchkes you could get in that pumpkin-y kind of a color. But anyway, it's a total tangent. So more importantly, what's up? What's new? What are you thinking you're going to do?
Well, on the tip of kind of visibility, I'd say a big theme and question that we've been grappling with probably, I mean, for the past few years, and particularly since Caitlin came into the campaign, was in really understanding a lot of the work the campaign can move as like flanking and supporting both internally, who really is leading and has the vision that we're following. So Black folks and other people of color, queer folks, folks who have disabilities, who is doing that work in within Unitarian Universalism as well as in movement spaces, and like what is our role to flank those folks who are leading that work? And feeling some deep questions about what the role of being visible and taking credit is within that, and like at times in conflict, and at times that like there actually is a very specific required or requested role of visibility. And so I think that we've been thinking a lot around how, if Side of Love is a way that people visualize their experience and how they show up in the world, how do we complicate or expand the ways that might not require you to be on the internet about it, and just maybe the kind of more mundane work of relationships and showing up that are actually profoundly moving forward the things that we say that we want. And at the same time, not backing down from times when having very visible presence is particularly useful. So both around the colors, but as well as like the theological, like where is visibility fit into it? And understanding that, you know, at the time of its inception, it sounds like having a spiritual and faith visible stance around specific issues was actually very politically useful. And seeing now, is visibility required in the same ways? And like, who are we saying we are when we show up wearing a shirt versus not? And I think that as someone who's been able to support some of the public witnesses the past few years, that's been a really useful, hearty conversation with partner organizations about when and how that is contributing to and moving a narrative forward, and when it actually is recentering folks who don't necessarily need to be taking credit. So that's not answering the like brass tacks, but I think that is like a very meta question that we're really like grappling with as it relates to moving forward.
It's a deeply important question. I know when we started it, and I went to the mat on not saying Unitarian Universalists on the logo, and it was rough, but I was like, we don't corner the market on love. Like how, you know, but I notice when I'm out and about that many churches, you know, stencil their names on the back or somehow, and I understand they want people to know who they are. And that's a valid thing for people who are looking for spiritual community. But I agree with you that it's an edgy thing. And so I'm glad that you're having conversations about that, because they're certainly happening everywhere else. Elizabeth, you are the senior strategist. What are you strategizing?
All kinds of things. And big gratitude to you, Meg, for being part of crafting something that doesn't try to say that Unitarian Universalists have the corner on love. So this is the very beginning. Today is actually my first official day. I just moved my desk. So humbled before the tasks, for sure, and the big questions like Nora raised. I think we're clear and so grateful for former Director Caitlin's assessment that she brought, and so much of it continues to ring true in terms of trying to be a place where the courageous leading edge of UU and UU adjacent justice work can be supported, resonated, amplified, affirmed. And just on the like people putting their names on things, I think a lot about how much is it that this is a helpful thing to put our name on, and how much is it that like I have a pastoral need to be affirmed for the work I'm putting in. And I really want people to know that that was my effort, and that, and if we can be real about that, then there's a lot of other ways to get that need met. And to honor and share gratitudes with one another that may not require like blazing out on the top of our banners or all over, you know, Facebook. So, and I think that's connected to one of the things that I'm really grateful to offer leadership and support around is just like, what does it mean to offer spiritual sustenance in these times? And feel so grateful that there are so many folks, many of them Black, Indigenous, folks of color, queer folks, who are offering healing, vision, ways of rooting ourselves in our ancestors in this moment. And a lot of those folks are not inside of mainline religious spaces, which is a blessing and also can just be hard in terms of resources. So I think that's weaving those connections, amplifying the needed healing medicine that's out there, and then also figuring out, as Unitarian Universalists, knowing that we have a lot of that within us and a lot of skillful practitioners among us who can really offer sustenance in these times. And it's really just about like connecting and finding ways for that to come through. So that's definitely deep on my mind. And then I think going back to our earlier conversation about elections, you know, just constantly asking the question, who are we centering? Who are we prioritizing? Are we sinking a ton of resources into the idea that transformation may happen, you know, in particular for white folks and white folks who have some access to power? For me, it is a theological truth that people can transform and change. That feels really core to me. And I'm not in control of when that happens, how it happens. It may not be the moment when someone's heart can be shifted. And it may, in fact, never happen. And so strategy-wise, that's not going to be the priority, especially if we have other data points that that change may happen on a 15-year, 30-year, waiting for spirit to intervene timeline. And then we have other folks who, as Nora says, are like already in motion, doing the work, living the deep, deep universalist values of no one is disposable, the belief in interdependence that says, you know, my liberation is bound up in your liberation is bound up in mine. And I definitely see strategically our work to support those folks to unleash their power.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. I'm curious as to, practically speaking, what is your number one on your to-do list, other than organizing your new desk? What is your number one as a chief strategist, which sounds very political, but I guess it is, right? You're a spiritually political strategist. So I'm curious, what is your first top two? How about that?
Yeah, what a good question. And I will say, though, strategist is the title. Like, this is, at the end of the day, for me, will always be about spiritual leadership, which is about like reckoning with what our integrity calls us to, and supporting others to do the same and to answer to whoever is our God or utmost moral authority, or the moral authority of others. If we are not sure, if we feel like we're in a morally weak chapter of our lives. But in terms of priorities, so I, like others, I'm receiving a lot of nourishment from the writing of Adrienne Marie Brown and her text Emergent Strategy. And she talks about small is all and fractals, which, like, I am not a science person, so I'm on a learning curve about that. But truly understanding the relationship between big scale transformation and like my ability to impact whatever's in front of me. And so I think really trying to attend to that, and that, like, if in our conversations with one another, as UUA staff, with ministers, religious educators, lay justice leaders, folks in state action networks, folks who are sort of championing this work from wherever they're at, whatever their site of resistance is, if we can have another layer of, we are in this together, what helps you win helps me win. I think that is, like, to me, it's not about like, I have to be personally transformed before I do the work out in the world, but how I do the work does impact the transformation happening in the world. So paying attention to that is top on my list. And also just like, another like insight from Caitlin was really around morale, and like if we're having low morale, it's hard. Like it's hard. And so just like, what do we need to do? Do we need to be singing songs? Do we need more art on the walls? Do we need better snacks? Like I'm just always getting tutored again and again about how if the content does not feel aligned with the experience, we struggle. So if we're sitting in a room talking about spiritual nourishment and like it's dark and like no one has water and like the tables are like sad, it's hard. So a concise way to say what I've said very lengthily is embodiment. Like how can we embody in everything we do what we're striving for? Just a little priority. Trying to move that forward. And then I think the other piece is paying really what we're resourcing and how is that, you know, we talk about budgets being, you know, moral documents. So, and I think that goes, one of the things I'm so grateful for is though it's a sad transition for me to leave the ministry with youth and young adults of color, I feel so excited about whoever may come into that role and bring their gifts and wisdom, things that I was crappy at that they'll be brilliant at. And it gave me a really profound opportunity to connect with some of our leaders who are young adults of color in particular, who are brilliant organizers and often embedded in exactly the type of campaigns that we say we want to support, and they're already doing it. And so part of the resource question is also, how do we really if folks want to take on greater leadership, say, like, we see what you're doing and it's a brilliant expression of Unitarian Universalist values and we want to support that. Embodiment, resources, priorities.
That is really exciting. I felt absolutely ministered to there. And I just want to be the third person to lift up Caitlin Breedlove, who just, departed, who brought amazing gifts to us and still is through Auburn Seminary now. But hat tip there, really amazing organizer. And one of the things she started was the Fortitude podcast, which she's still doing from Auburn now. I noticed, Elizabeth, that you lift up music a lot in your, I noticed in your last email, there was like, here's a song you can listen to. And that's exciting to me. Is music a big part of movements?
Absolutely. And I feel like that's also a gift that Nora brings as someone who is really good at tracking and curating the soundtracks that we need. And also like the Revive Love Tour, which I was not part of and can take no credit for, but I think was, you know, Lena and Caitlin and Nora and other folks really thinking like in the frame that I heard, like an offering, not an ask. What can we offer to frontline folks? We ask so much. And music, I think, being core among that as something that heals and empowers. And you know, something that is really clear that we've put in writing again and again is that it is a priority to offer culturally relevant, nourishing stuff to folks. And, you know, there are limits in terms of digital and like, gosh, emails, that's a very specific medium with lots of gifts and lots of limitations. And the idea that you can like, yeah, send people like mixes basically in a hyperlink send people to other mixes that, you know, a leader that I might admire but never meet in my life has made and feel like in some ways connected to her work or like tapping into a bit of what is sustaining her, I think is just a remarkable aspect. So I think, you know, cultural organizing over the centuries, you know, again, often led by folks of color, domestic context, and you know, incredible organizations that are centering art. That is not like who we're going to be, but I think we can echo the affirmation of how central that is. And also just spiritual practices, like I'm so bad at so many things and I got to pray about things and sing about things. And I truly believe that we sometimes underestimate the spiritual practices that we have for the work of justice. Like some of us know what we would do if our kid was really, really sick. And like probably a significant chunk of that is not spiritual practice, but is like problem solving and freaking out, which is exactly what people should be doing. And also we may feel like, okay, then I would like call this minister, or then I would like put on this song and blast it, or like then I would like go to the gym and try to work up a sweat. And we can actually do those same things when we feel devastated or despair, or when like someone has just called us out on Facebook and we think our life is over. And so part of it is also just like helping us know what we already know. Anyways, now I got sidetracked.
I think holistic. I think it sounds like what you're getting at, which I think is so crucial and important, is a holistic approach to activism and justice work that is theologically rooted, whether, you know, your music and meditation and spiritual practice. But what does it look like to present ourselves in the world and work for justice and also take care of ourselves? Because when we're depleted, then we're toast. So I appreciate that very much.
Indeed. And Nora, you've been there. You've been doing an amazing job for a long time, and I'm really excited about the two of you as a team. What do you have to say about that? And you also cited, and I just wanted to mention, Lena Gardner here in Minneapolis did a great conversation yesterday talking about Adrienne Marie Brown and Octavia Butler, and it was fun to be there and hear it. And it's live streamed at Kaleo Center. K-A-L-E-O, Kaleo Center, which has a Facebook page. So if you weren't there, you don't have to just be jealous. But you've been at this. What do you see evolving, and what are you excited about?
Yeah, I think a lot of the things Elizabeth shared around like relevant content that meets people's needs and fills in gaps is something I'm so excited about. And so not to like overstate the usefulness of email, but like not getting boring emails is like a new goal, like, or not sending emails that people are like, this is dry. And so something we started experimenting with like 8 or 10 weeks ago was these biweekly emails that include some info about a UU ancestor who's come before, who's done justice work, a song and a prayer. And that's been an opportunity for me that Elizabeth has pushed me on to like learn how to write prayers, which has been by doing it and just reading them. And I think really excited about thinking more broadly around how we scale and support leadership of folks who are already doing the work. So like Elizabeth said, that is kind of rethinking what we mean when we say resourcing people and supporting folks. And I think Elizabeth brought something to a conversation we had yesterday, which was kind of the methodology of youth organizing that she's been part of in the past around organizing yourself out of a job. And so more broadly, I think that raises questions for me about kind of like who brought us into the work that we're doing and like who are we bringing along? And if we're not consistently developing people who could replace us, what are we doing? And I think that is in contradiction with the way that most systems and institutions operate, right? But it feels really, really crucial knowing the small number of gatekeepers to institutions, as little or big as the UUA is, but even within congregational settings and within social justice ministry and groups, you know, like, how are we supporting and bringing new people into leadership all the time? And what does that mean for the role that we see ourselves playing, which is still relevant and necessary, but like always evolving, hopefully, as we continue to gain greater skills and also understand that the landscape is shifting and something different might be needed of us next. Around kind of the creative cultural work, I just want to like shout out both Black Youth Project 100 and Dream Defenders, who have been like at the forefront of doing extraordinary digital interventions that is like supportive and uplifting. And I think what makes it so profound is their ground game. So like them alone on the internet is beautiful because they work with extraordinary graphic designers and other people who do really cool work. But what really is impactful is that they're running real campaigns. And so I think them as two like Black youth and young adult led organizations. I know this is now a couple years old, but Umi Selah, who was one of the founders of Dream Defenders, maybe 2.5 years ago, put this, he was part of a day long talk around ego and role, and talked about why the Dream Defenders had basically gone offline for a year to really reevaluate what was the role of their public presence and persona, and kind of how short-term notoriety is in a social justice term. So talked about like, we were a funder darling last year and now we're not. And like, what does that mean for our ability to like still be doing base building, still be relevant and still actually be moving campaigns? And I think that really like going to the folks who are moving the work as opposed to the folks who might be getting shine feels like a cultural change in many ways. So I'm really excited about continuing to figure out what that means. And maybe those things are happening at the same time. That's not to say people shouldn't be celebrated and like get shine. But I do think Caitlin, again, has been asking really publicly on our Facebook, which you can see whether or not you're friends, what is the role of ego within leadership? And kind of we're all leaders and gatekeepers in some way. And so like, where does our ego, and for those of us who are white, I think it's particularly necessary, like where does the affirmation that we're seeking fit into our public persona or actions or silence?
Aisha, you look like you have a response to all that. I was listening to it partly going, it's religious education. These are religious educators talking. Are you hearing that too?
Yes. I mean, that's in the context of, I missed now the line you had just said that I was like, yes, how do we, especially what I'm, okay, in light of the context of since really the election, and I don't think the white supremacy teach-in would have happened without this election. I think if Hillary won, I just think it would have kind of fell flat because everybody would have said, everything's fine. And what I'm realizing, where is the ego in this? And one of the things I'm also trying to be mindful of, and this was touched on also, is pastoral care for folks who genuinely are saying, I'm personally confused, hurt, offended, what have you, and I want to do the right thing. I don't know what the right answer is, but it sounds like the direction that answering the side of love, just making up a new slogan for y'all, is going in that direction. And I think it's crucial because I don't want to be insensitive. And I also feel like there's so much to be done. And yes, there are people who just are stuck not knowing what to do. And I think the ego has something to do with that. It's like, but I'm a good person. I marched in the 60s. I'm well-meaning. I think the right things, right? We think the right things. We read the right books. And so how do we translate doing all the right things, take care of ourselves, and still move forward? And I go back to, how do we teach people to sit in discomfort? And I don't, yeah. And I think that's an important piece of that. Would you say that, or am I going off track, Nora?
No, not at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I kind of loved, Meg, that you told the little anecdote about like the shirts not coming in the colors that you all had in your minds, because so much is like way more messy and way more mundane than we would like to imagine. And then like in 20 years, it's like one cute headline. And really it was like 17 multidimensional things that probably involved like someone forgetting the food in a car and like all of the seltzer water freezing and exploding right before the training. And then like the speaker dropping out at the last minute and someone asking someone else. And then they were the person who needed to be there, you know? And I think being able to hold with a lot of integrity and honesty what it looks like to build together and not tell these stories that it's simple or tidy. I mean, I have been part just of so many actions that I fear that people see the headline and think, oh, you know, Elizabeth, she just knows how to like be part of the stuff that's the right things to be part of. And I want to say, do you know how many text messages of how awful it was and how it was going to fall apart and how it was the wrong ask and the wrong target and we couldn't get the people, and then it was like impacting people in the wrong way, and the lawyer said it wasn't smart, like, and then people said it was top down. Like, it's always like that. And so we are already saved from perfection. So here we are. And I think that message feels like a bomb for those of us who are maybe more enmeshed in shift systems right now. But I also hope that it can also be a bomb for folks who feel like, gosh, like, I know that this is wrong, but I don't know what to do. And that, like, no one has ever had the one answer and no one ever will. So you don't have to even bother looking. But yeah, I think I see that in myself over and over, and I see that in others so often, that we just wish we could outsource the messy moral struggling of, like, is that really the right organization to give my money to? Is that really, like, is this the thing I should upturn my entire week to show up at? And it's like, you cannot get an app for that. You really can't. And so probably rather than wait for someone to come out with an app that's never going to be made, like, how do you then have the spiritual fortitude to be like, oh, I went to that thing, there were two people at it, it wasn't a good use of time, and that's okay. I'm okay. I don't have to regret that for the rest of my life. I can just do the next thing.
Please make a t-shirt, saved from perfection, please. In whatever colors, please, I will wear
it. Pumpkin,
spice. Saved from perfection. Please, somebody make a note of that. That needs to happen.
Nora, did you want to say more about that?
I do think there's a piece also around muscularity that just means that for those of us who do have significant privilege, like, we just need to be more rigorous with ourselves around, like, what it actually is going to take. And I see that on the local level in DC organizing, and I've seen that definitely in my capacity here, which is, like, sometimes when we ask how can we be of use and what can we offer, and the answer that we get is something that we actually don't want, we just don't feel like doing, it's not even something that we can't do, we need to, like, really be clear what we're then saying. And that's not to say we can't have, like, principal disagreement about strategy and, like, work through those things together. But I do think sometimes, like, the opt-in mentality, or, like, wanting to just be like, I would like a list of 17 things that I could do to support this, and I'll choose two, and the other 15 might actually be, like, really necessary also. So, like, when we are actually in deep, meaningful relationship, being able to understand, like, why and how. And I think this is coming for me out of the, like, belief that we're, like, poised to do something, and, like, what we actually are being asked to do might be something completely different. And so what Elizabeth and I think experienced doing some of the support work to Karen Van Fossen and the other extraordinary folks who were doing the both legal and home hospitality support around legal protectors in Standing Rock, I think was, like, a deeply humbling way that, like, the expansiveness of ministry that's mandated in times of crises, and I think that we obviously have many, many other lessons, but it is that, like, we all have many roles to play, and sometimes what we feel like we've been trained on might actually not be what's needed. And so, like, having the, like, humility and flexibility to be able to, like, fill those gaps, and also being clear that, like, co-creating vision is necessary. And what is not being asked of us right now is, or I don't believe what is being asked of us is to wait for the strategic plan for transforming fill in the blank. I think it is going to require some work from all of us. And so I do just invite folks into, like, figuring out, have you been asked to do something that you've just decided not to? And are you willing to either directly tell people why you're unwilling to do that, or are you willing to maybe do the work that it takes to get you there?
Totally. And just thinking, like, also inviting folks into, like, a little mapping, like, is there a pattern of things that people have wanted to do, but because they're not happening on my timeline or in the format that I always imagined, I'm not engaging? And also just thinking, like, this is super specific, but, like, I feel like a lot of my clergy colleagues and religious educator colleagues have, like, a sort of internal, maybe unexplicit vetting of like, oh, if this person is in the hospital, I will drop everything and offer pastoral support. And I just like factor that into my work plan. And how do we do that around justice work as well? Because what I'm hearing a lot of folks say is like, oh, I really want to be there, but the turnaround time for the ask, and I like really want to write a deep piece on time, which is a different thing, but it doesn't work for me. And like, if that has happened every day or every week for like a couple months, at what point do you say like, maybe the timeline of the asks isn't going to change, but I could change how prepared I am for those asks. So just that's my thing about time that I want to think through.
I can't wait to see your thought piece on time. You know, it occurs to me, and I always end up being the old person in this show, but that spiritual practice on developing humility feels really important, because I think for those of us who had our peak as like the leaders and are now going, yeah, but that's not what you're supposed to be doing now. There is a kind of humility that I see my peers really struggling to find, especially ministers, I will say. And I don't even know what the practices would be, but I feel like I could use them. And I bet a lot of other people could too. So I'll just throw that into your huge pile.
Yes, please. Oh my gosh, I would be so excited about that. And yes, other folks, if you have visions for ways we can be of use in things that you are craving, what are we, Nora? love@uua.org?
Yep.
love@uua.org. That is awesome.
That's a good handle. Well, it is really wonderful to have the two of you here, and I'm really excited to see what all you're going to be doing. And thank you for modeling the kind of leadership that feels so important. And, you know, and I mean, we haven't talked about it, but you're doing this at a time, Aisha mentioned the white supremacy teach-in, and we've had a real, I think, shifting leadership that we're seeing. We have the co-moderators on, and boy, that was a different piece of life. And of course, we don't know who will come in and do that eventually, but I'm just, as a last question, this time that you're in at the UUA nationally, do you see particular moments that you feel like are just right for you?
This is my first time being in the office since June. But what I would say is, I don't know how you can convey this via Zoom, but like, there has been a fundamental shift in the amount of spiritually responsive grounding that happens in mundane administrative meetings in ways that I'm like, whoa, okay, cool. So I like really want to appreciate Reverend Susan Frederick Gray, who feels like she has ministered to us before we talk about our health benefits package changing or something, but actually feels like she's really like grounded the conversation in a resonant response to what people are experiencing and like the trauma and horrors of the world. And that does feel like a profound opportunity. In the way that we are, like, that is what we are here for, and that is like what we are good at, and that is our lane. And we are not a social justice organization that's going to add on something spiritual, you know, at the end. And so that does feel like a profound spiritual shift that I feel really excited about.
Yeah, echoing that. And I do think there is like, you know, when we see things fail, it sometimes creates more space. And so like, as we keep seeing failures of a single man in leadership, I think that there's then space for like collaborations of lots of different types and the invitation of humility. Like, I only have a few things, but Nora's got a bunch of other ones, and so does Meg, and so does Aisha. And like, it's not about like me trying to build my brand. It's like, what is the ecosystem we're building? And I think Reverend Susan Frederick Gray and others are on board and are visionary around that. And I also just want to just give gratitude, because I think a lot of people have put in huge amounts of work to get us to this point and paid pretty significant personal costs in terms of leadership. And you know, Christina Rivera, among many others, and leaders of Black Lives of UU. And so it's not like this has emerged out of nothing. But I think we are in a place where utility and generativeness and yeah, where like we laugh more in meetings.
I think there's also a question of what is to be done when harm happens and like how do we actually grapple with that and like how do we center experience is of people who are harmed and what is being asked of people in leadership when that does happen. And I do feel like there is space to think differently around restoration and relationship while like being unwavering in what we understand our vision to be, which is centering experiences of people who have experienced that harm.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here. It's been really exciting. We're going to take next week off for Thanksgiving. I hope that everybody in the U.S. has a good holiday and people in other places, you can listen to an old podcast. The week after that, we're having Russ Funk, an old friend of mine who's been working for decades in about violent men, coming to talk about masculine toxic masculinity, which we had scheduled long ago, but certainly is in the news these days. So anyway, so that'll be another great week. Thank you again so much to Nora and Elizabeth for all your great work.
Thank you all.
Aisha, have a great holiday.
Thank you. You too. Thanks, everybody. It was excellent.
Take care.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.